Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan, and I'm filling in for Steve this afternoon. Steve is under the weather, unfortunately, and he will be back next Sunday afternoon. So I'm filling in today. Our guest this afternoon is Clayton Doffenbaugh, who is an ecologist on preserving natural areas, specifically in the area of southern Utah, although he has broader interest as well. And he's here to talk to us this afternoon about saving the wilderness, specifically with respect to some interest that he has in southern Utah. And we want to talk to him about that from a Christian perspective. He recently spoke on campus this weekend at the Wesley Foundation. So we have an interesting convergence of issues. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Doffenbaugh.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, you are the Midwest Regional Organizer for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Yes, that's right.
And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance is a organization based in Utah whose sole mission is to protect the Red Rock Canyonlands in the Colorado Plateau portion of Utah, mostly in the south central and southeastern part of the state. And my job is to travel around the Midwest and educate people about the need to protect these lands and invite them to participate in a national effort to assure those protections, the ones that are there, remain, and additional ones that are necessary that we ultimately attain those.
Now, you are a member of LaGrange First United Methodist Church, is that right?
Yes, that's correct, and 25 years or so.
25 years,
yeah.
Wow. And you are a member of their Environmental Justice Committee, is that right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And you have been available and been involved in speaking engagements at various venues, secular and religious, throughout the Midwestern area on the general topic of
that's what I get paid to do. So right. Yes, indeed.
All right. How did you get involved in this from a faith perspective, from a Christian's perspective? What is there about being a Methodist that has anything to do with the environment or your interest in the environment?
Well, my experiences in wilderness hiking out west, primarily. I also spend some time hiking up in the UP and Michigan and forest areas as well. Mystical experiences, spiritual experiences in wild places has been the underlying motivator for my advocacy to protect wilderness areas. I've had times, in the Methodist tradition with John Wesley, he talks about his heart being strangely warmed on occasion, and that would be the kind of experience I would say I've had out in wild places. It comes to me if I try to bring it on. That's the surest way of preventing it. But these are times when I feel a real connection to eternity. I feel a presence of another being there. It's almost like a conversation mm-hmm. that you're having about being a small part of the universe and of eternity, but that connection that I feel in those moments too is a very ennobling mm-hmm. Sort of feeling, and I feel a sense of meaning that grows out of that, and it's really a without words a conversation that takes place with the world around me and other people as well, and it's like talking with the Creator.
Just so that our guests know, if you're interested in talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh on saving the wilderness, and in particular we're going to get to a special interest and career focus of his, and that is the southern Utah wilderness area and current legislation related to that. This is a call-in show, and feel free to call in. Our local number is 333-9455. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, I grew up in Texas as a Southern Baptist, and I can remember from my teen years, still in the back of my head, I won't sing it, but the hymn went, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue." Just as a provocative question, isn't there a long-standing tradition rooted in St. Augustine going all the way through the medieval era that nature and this world, or the what Augustine might call the city of man, is just not of special interest to Christians? This world is not our home. We're just a passing through. How would you respond to, and I'm sure you've encountered Christians in particular, or people from other faiths, particularly in the Western tradition, who think that way about nature? What do you say to them?
Well, I would say from my own personal experience, as I've just described, that my feelings of connections to eternity that I think people from that perspective are talking about, those connections to spiritual life, to a heavenly sort of presence, have come as a result of, or as at the same time as, in coordination with my experiences out in natural places in the created world. And so I think it's not accurate to separate those two things, to say that even if this is just a brief blimp in my history or the eternal history at all, it is a brief blimp in that history, and therefore it's an important part of it, because all aspects of creation are important, whether they're the earthly side or the heavenly side, the spiritual side or the material side. And I, from a Christian perspective, the Apostle Paul, in one of his letters, talks about creation as being a second scripture, and that we can learn from the created world much about God, that God's creation is a revelation of God's character. And so I think it behooves us to pay some attention to what we can learn from the created order. And certainly Jesus was quite concerned himself with the world around him. So I think it's actually a part of the Christian faith and many other faiths to be concerned about the world as we're living in it now.
Yeah, you in one of your writings you mentioned John was in the wilderness, Jesus went to the wilderness for temptations, and Muhammad went to a cave to receive the teachings of Allah. The wilderness is really shot through at the beginning of Western religious traditions, right?
Absolutely. The Moses in the burning bush, it was in the wilderness. You know, where did the Ten Commandments come?
That's right.
That mountain was a central feature of that story and of those events.
And the wandering in the wilderness for 40 years.
The Israelites, when they left Egypt, they became a nation wandering in the wilderness, and that time spent there and their interactions with God as a result of that experience and God's creation is what made them what they were and prepared them for their entrance into the Holy Land. The Gospel of Mark begins by setting the entire framework of Jesus's ministry in the wilderness, you know, a voice crying in the wilderness, which there is a reference to John the Baptist, who is very much of a wilderness character himself. Transfiguration took place in the wilderness, Jesus repeatedly retreating to wild places for opportunities for prayer and to be close to God.
And Buddha went off to the jungle.
Buddha, you know, under a tree in the foothills of the Himalayas mm-hmm. is where he got his inspiration, the central epiphanies of the key figures of many of the world's religions mm-hmm. all took place in wild places.
Right.
So it's a thread that runs through the whole faith tradition.
So how do you account for this spin on otherworldliness in the Christian tradition that disdains nature in the wilderness? It's real, isn't it, in particularly in the evangelical community?
Certainly. There's some folks who have they're so attuned to or try to be so attuned to the spiritual side of their lives that that I think that they miss or neglect that other connection that's out there. But just as as Christians experience Christ and other people, it's possible to experience Christ with the rest of God's created world. Mm-hmm. I mean, God is the creator. Jesus is God's son. There's a connection there. Paul in his letter to the Colossians makes that very explicit.
Mm-hmm.
Even among the most famous verses in Scripture, John 3:16, talks about God sent his only son to save the world. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say to save the people. Says to save the world. So I think that suggests that our salvation as people is bound together with the salvation of the planet.
The apocryphal tradition within evangelical Christianity, specifically that gives a more literal interpretation to time and space that sees the coming of Jesus imminently, is also widespread. And I don't know how you deal with that. Is it the case that Christian environmentalism, or what is sometimes called green Christians, is a movement that is more congenial to less literal understandings of the end times, do you think?
Well, that's a difficult question. I suppose that's probably true. But even if you look at the book of Revelation, a lot of that is, dealing with – it's not creating another world. It's dealing with the correction of this world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
The river of life that's at the end of the book of Revelation is a reference back to the Garden of Eden,
mm-hmm.
Which is all about how humans became estranged from God's creation and their proper role in it as stewards of that creation. And I would argue that that the book of Revelation, which is of course central to the apocalyptic stream of Christianity, would say that no, when the world is saved, the world will be saved, and that includes the planet around mm-hmm. us and us as creatures within mm-hmm. that larger creation.
Well, I came across a passage from an evangelical declaration on global warming by the Cornwall Alliance. Interesting rhetoric here. We believe Earth and its ecosystems created by God's intelligent design and infinite power and sustained by his faithful providence are robust, resilient, self-regulating, and self-correcting, admirably suited for human flourishing and displaying his glory. This goes on to talk about why global warming is not an issue, but it could also focus on other environmental issues as well. It appears to me that this kind of language is an indicator of a congealing or a more coherent argument from the backlash that I'm sure you've encountered in the evangelical movement, Christian movement. And I'm intrigued with that and how you see dealing with it politically. You are working in southern Utah. Are you working in the Midwest on behalf of an environmental – important set of environmental issues in southern Utah, which we'll talk about in just a few minutes. And I take it you have encountered some resistance there as well. Is that right? from a Christian perspective or a Mormon perspective in particular?
Well, the Mormon – I'm not Mormon, so right. You have to take anything I say about that with a grain of salt.
You're a good Methodist.
Yes, that's correct. My understanding is that there is actually a substantial appreciation for the created world within the Mormon tradition. It perhaps isn't as high profile as it may have been at one time, but certainly most of the people in the state of Utah, according to polling data and just anecdotal experiences we've had in working on the Wilderness Protection Campaign, are supportive of efforts to protect the special places mm-hmm. in that state.
And you've had some success, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. I mean, the organization that I work for is based in the state of Utah. It's an outgrowth of that state and the people there. And most of the people who work on this as volunteers in the campaign come from that state, though certainly we have people all across the country. It is a mm-hmm. national effort to protect those lands. So you might not be able to say the same for the support or lack thereof from the elected officials.
Governor
in the state
Herbert
of Utah.
Is resisting. Is that what you're saying?
Governor Herbert is currently most all of the elected officials in the state would not be counted as proponents of the land protection effort that we're seeking. On the other hand, they have moved over the years too, and there is now a greater willingness to accept larger amounts of wilderness protection in the state than there once was, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so there's been some element of responsiveness to the growth and support among Utahns for wilderness protection in the state.
Just a reminder, listeners, this is a call-in show, and we're talking to Clayton Doffenbaugh, who is the Midwest Regional Coordinator. Is that right?
Coordinator, organizer.
Organizer, coordinator.
Any of those will do.
Troublemaker for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Mm-hmm. And we're talking with him about a faith perspective on environmentalism in the general sense and in particular about environmental issues associated with Southern Utah conservation issues, which we'll get to in just a second. Before we completely leave, let me just remind everyone that you can call in to ask Mr. Doffenbaugh a question about these topics by calling in 333-9455. You can also call 1-800-222-9455. There's a word of art within the Christian evangelical literature called the Green Commandment. Are you acquainted with that?
I'm not.
Actually. The stewardship commandment in the Garden of Eden?
The commandment to till and to keep.
Right.
There's also a third commandment in that story. I believe it had to do with leaving alone a portion of the created world, which was actually the action that took place within that story resulted in the fall was the failure to leave alone a part of the created order to exist in its own right. And that's kind of what I was referring to earlier
right.
by that, the estrangement, the alienation of humans from the rest of the created world in which we live and the mm-hmm. way we view that created order is very much a part of the concept of original sin and the fall of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Original sin being a sin that you don't just do once. It's one that you repeat over and over and over mm-hmm. again mm-hmm. for a very long period of time. And we seem to still be doing it. So,
what's the difference between stewardship and ownership? A lot of people I talk to about that topic seem to think that mankind was given ownership of the world. And that's not the term.
Again, from a Christian perspective, I think the scriptures are pretty clear that the planet belongs to God and not to the people who are on it. And the role of humans in this planet is to act as stewards of that created order. Certainly we take from it what we need to survive and to flourish, as all other creatures do too. But we're not to do that from the standpoint of abusing the creation or seriously damaging or destroying portions of it. You made reference earlier to people talking about global warming and saying that God's creation is sufficient unto itself.
It'll take
self-regulating.
Care of itself. It's perfect.
And I think it is self-regulating and sufficient unto itself, and it has a way of dealing with problems that arise, and when
including us,
and when certain creatures overwhelm their surrounding environment, God's creation has a way of taking corrective action, and we may find some of that occurring if we don't straighten out our act and start protecting more of the special places in creation and leaving some of it alone and extracting less and abusing less than what we do.
So you see this, how would you classify that? I know you're not a theologian, but would you see this as in the category of sin?
Yes, I think it's clear. I mean, any time you you abuse something and cause it harm, I think that falls within the category of sin, and that certainly relates to the rest of God's creation as mm-hmm. well as it does to people.
You're also a Midwestern guy. How did you get involved with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance?
Traveling out west with my wife, hiking, enjoying those experiences, coming on those spiritual experiences as well, and at some point deciding that even though I lived in the Midwest, I needed to have some connection to the land out there and to helping it out. And so SUA, as it's known by its acronym, is one of the organizations that I got involved with mm-hmm. in that effort.
How did you find out about it when you were there? You just through contacts?
Honestly, I don't remember how I found out about that.
How long have you been involved?
I've been a member of SUA since 1995. So quite a while as a volunteer for most of that time, but now as an employee.
Right. What are the Redlands?
The Red Rock Canyon lands?
Not everybody knows Utah.
It's one of the most spectacular and unique places on Earth. If you took the Grand Canyon and spread it out over an area about 400 miles wide on each side, you'd have an idea of what the entire Colorado Plateau is like and the Red Rock Canyonlands of Utah in particular. It's a maze of canyons and bluffs and mountains, all of red rock. Slot canyons and streams.
When you come across Colorado and you go down,
that's right.
Isn't that around 2,000 feet high? That area, or is it higher?
It varies. It gets as low as 2,000. It'll get as high as 7,000 or 8,000.
Oh, okay.
If you get up into some of the forested plateaus, it gets as high as 10,000 feet. Yeah. It's quite a variety of topography in the region. It's one of the things that makes it so spectacular.
Right.
But you can stand on a high area there, and on a clear day, you have a 150-mile view out around you, and it's one of the most awe-inspiring vistas on the planet. And it's one of those places, I mean, with the geology just laid out before you, you can see eternity out there in front of you. And it's hard for it not to get under your skin. I don't know too many people who've spent more than a few days out there who don't find it really being something that impacts on the rest of their life. It's an amazing landscape.
There are five really big national parks in Utah.
Yes.
And is Bryce
Canyon
in that
that's
area?
One of the national, yes.
What are the others down in the
there's
south?
Zion National Park,
Zion, right.
Capitol Reef, Canyonlands, and Arches.
And there are a number of threats to those that I take it your organization is resisting. One of those is what do they call it? The vehicles.
Off-road vehicles.
Yes. And a lot of there's an annual Provo Jeep event.
There are various Jeep safaris that take place from time to time. But there, people are out there, year-round.
So recreational uses of the land are a problem, right?
Particularly those kinds of recreation. very damaging to the lands. Our protection effort is focused on the lands surrounding the national parks, the viewshed of the national parks. If you have standing in a park and have one of those 150-mile views, most of that land in your view is not protected. It's still public land, federal land. So the citizens of the country are, at least in legal terms, if not spiritual terms, the owners of the land out there. But it doesn't necessarily have protective status, and so we're trying to do that. And off-road vehicles are one of the most damaging things to that terrain. With between that red rock is a lot of red dirt, and on top of that red dirt grows collections of plants that hold it into place. And among the things that can disturb those soil crusts is they're known, it's among that are most disturbing are off-road vehicles. And if they drive over it, they can crush it, and you end up with a lot of dust in the air that blows into Colorado, and they have now what they call the pink snow. It darkens the snow, and it contributes greatly along with climate change to the snow melt in that area, and it's threatening the water supply for the region. And so if we protect these lands, it becomes illegal to enter them through motorized means, and it's a way of not only protecting the land but protecting the water supply.
Right. We do have a caller. Line four, hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment for Clayton Doffenbaugh.
Hi, Clayton. This is Denise. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Hey, I was listening while I went to the radio this this afternoon while I was doing my schoolwork. I'm a teacher, and happened to hear that you were going to be on. I'm one of those volunteers. I live in Indiana. I'm from Wisconsin, and it's been a fabulous experience for me. My perspective for saving wilderness is actually a little bit different. And I don't know if you describe what wilderness really means. The land in Utah that we're trying to preserve has been deemed wilderness. It's something that Congress can only preserve as wilderness. There have been studies done, and this is pristine land, a term that's used as untrammeled. And the thing is, it's the in Utah, it's the largest expanse of wilderness quality land in the lower 48 states. And unfortunately, this incredible landscape is being slowly destroyed. So what we're trying to do, and it's a lot of volunteers like me, I'm passionate about saving our last wild places here in this beautiful country. And we have been making some progress. If you've never been to Utah, I've only been there a couple times. In fact, I had been there 20 years ago, and I happened upon the opportunity to help preserve wilderness in Utah. And even though it had been 20 years, I thought, wow, this is really great to be able to go to Washington, D.C., talk to people, do some things here in Indiana to let people know about this fabulous place and the efforts being made to preserve wilderness. And if you are a Christian, I would like, I hope that you have Clayton's perspective, because there's another Christian perspective, which I know some people, including family members, that think that this is the earth is what God has given people, and it is ours to use any way we wish. Again, my perspective is very different from that, for sure. And there are a lot of things that have happened in a positive way. And maybe, I don't know if you've mentioned this already, Clayton, but maybe you could talk about the impact individuals can really make. You know, people really do make a difference. If you have an issue and you're concerned about it, it really, really, truly has an impact. If you could talk about what people can do and the actual progress that has been made to preserve this land. It is, if you've never been there, listeners, you need to go. There are several wonderful national parks, and the Bureau of Land Management land is also pretty incredible. And that's why I do what I do. I've spent lots, hundreds and hundreds of dollars to do this, because it means a lot to me. And I'm not a not a wealthy person, but it really has been a great opportunity to do something positive. So anyways, I'm going to, it's great to hear you, Clayton, and I'm going to finish my dinner with my husband, Bill.
Well, thank you for your call. Mr. Dorfbaugh, you want to respond?
Sure. I think
sounds
Denise
like
has given us, we could spend the rest of our time talking about some of the topics she's outlined there. First of all, I mean, we do have a great amount of support in Indiana, and it's good to hear Denise's voice a little unexpectedly, but an unexpected pleasure. Because she's one of the more stalwart supporters in the state of Indiana, we need to clone her. But yeah, she's right. Wilderness protection, the formal absolute protection, permanent protection of wilderness is something that only Congress under United States laws can provide. There are other lesser levels of protection that can be done administratively through the Department of Interior and the White House, such as national monuments or providing wildlands designations to have a temporary protective status for lands. And it's people across the country who work to build the support and encourage our public officials, elected and otherwise, to maintain those protections that have enabled us to really stem the losses 50 years ago in Utah of the 20 million or so BLM lands. It's a little over that. About 80% of them were in a wild state. And 25 years ago, that was down to about 40%. And that's when we started getting organized. And you know, we've held that. There's very little of that land that has been lost from its wild character. There are some damages and some threats, certainly. The fundamental wild character of that land remains, and it's a result of people writing Congress, contacting the Department of Interior all around the country. Here in Illinois, we're particularly fortunate in that Senator Durbin is the lead sponsor of the legislation that would protect these lands and a champion in many other ways for protecting them. Tim Johnson, who is the congressman here in the Champaign-Urbana area, has often been the leading Republican voice in the United States Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, for protecting the Red Rock wilderness lands in the state of Utah, and has stepped out in front in addition to co-sponsorship to help out as well. Senator Kirk was a co-sponsor in the House of Representatives and said during the campaign that he would co-sponsor this legislation again. And we're looking forward to him fulfilling that when the legislation gets reintroduced in April. So, you know, and those things don't happen without average American citizens stepping up and speaking out on behalf of these extraordinary places in southern Utah.
Now, the caller spoke about activities that people locally can be involved in. You have an article about this that you might want to talk a little bit about, hosting events, supporting wilderness areas, small group discussions, mm-hmm. passing formal resolutions, quote, the earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, worship, prayer, and visiting a wild area.
There's all sorts of things people can do. I mean, part of my job is to travel around and talk with folks. That's what was happening at Wesley here in town this afternoon. There's a slideshow that we can present. It takes about 15 minutes plus the rest of the talk around it that can be presented. We can send that to people and they can do it themselves along with literature. Organizations have sent letters to federal officials on behalf of protecting these lands. You know, secular as well as communities of faith have written in about it. So that's something people can do. Also, they can write their own individual letters to Congress. They can hold their own community educational events as well, and we can help them with that. There's information about those things on SUA's website, which is www.suwa.org, or people can email me directly at Clayton at SUA.org. as well, and learn more information about those kind of activities. But it's the bedrock, the foundation of these protection efforts, making use of our democratic rights and privileges here in the good old U.S. of A.
We are talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh this afternoon on Keeping the Faith. He's here to talk to us about saving the wilderness with particular respect to his work for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance as a Midwest regional organizer. And if you'd like to call in to talk with Mr. Doffenbaugh about these and related issues, particularly with respect to Utah and the Christian perspective on environmentalism, you can call in at 333-9455. You can also call on 800 number 1-800-222-9455. As I understand it, Secretary Salazar is reversing some Bush administration, or has reversed Bush administration's policies towards the wilderness. Are you, in general, as an organization, happy with what he's done and its effect on Utah?
By and large, yes. Its impact on Utah will remain to see how the policy is implemented in the future across the state. It's a policy that affects the whole country, all of the Bureau of Land Management lands all over the country. So it's a far-reaching policy. Basically, what he's done has been to reinstate for the Bureau of Land Management their implementation of the law that tells the Bureau of Land Management how it's supposed to go about its business. The Federal Land Policy and Management Act instructs the Bureau of Land Management to inventory for wilderness characteristics on the land and to make provision for protecting those characteristics in the majority of instances. And under President Bush, in a court settlement with the state of Utah, that they quit implementing that aspect of the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. And what Secretary Salazar has done is gone back, I would say, 75-80% of the way to the way it was done under every president prior to President Bush in terms of reinstituting that process. And so we're hopeful that it would be helpful in providing some protections for the lands. We're particularly interested in seeing the Obama administration look at the region surrounding Canyonlands National Park. It's one of the places in the wilderness proposal put together by citizens that has the least amount of protections. It's some of the more spectacular lands, and it's the largest remaining uninhabited portion of the lower 48 states. And so we believe it's especially deserving of protections under the wildlands policy. You know, whatever President Obama, he has a number of authorities that he could use, including the designation of national monuments, which has been done in the past to help establish many of the national parks around the country.
I looked at a map, and it's very splotchy, right? The number of lands protected compared to those juxtaposed to them.
Yes, that's
so
correct.
Protecting the actual ecology of the protected lands very much depends upon the surrounding areas.
If the Greater Canyonlands region was receive the kind of protections we would hope that it would. It would provide a link between other protected areas that would really run from the Grand Canyon, not entirely without interruption, but largely without interruption, up to Yellowstone National Park.
Wow. And, almost a corridor.
I would say a sizable corridor. And one of the places in the country that if you want to know what the frontier was like, go out to Utah and you can check it out. And it is certainly a reservoir. Again, the statement you were reading earlier from the evangelical organization, it's one of those places where they made references to resiliency. And it's one of those places where the created world is still resilient in its own right, and it's because people's hand has been relatively light in that area. And so providing these protections would help to continue that.
If there were, Carter, if you could wave a wand, what are the long-term benefits of that?
Well, the long-term benefits are
from the Grand Canyon all the way up to Yellowstone.
All the way up to Yellowstone. The benefits of that are much of it goes to the natural world. All of those creatures out there living on that land, from the largest to the smallest, they certainly would benefit. They will survive where otherwise
the grizzlies
they may not.
The grizzlies are challenged, aren't they?
Up in the Yellowstone region, grizzlies are one of the animals that's on the endangered species list. There are others as well.
And their numbers are declining, as I understand it.
They've somewhat stabilized here recently, but at a low level. Mm-hmm. It would be nice for their habitat to be more secure. They require large expanses of
land.
That's
what I was going to get at. Would they move south, or do they prefer the high
Yellowstone's
country?
About as far south as they go. They go up north through Montana up into Canada, mm-hmm. where in Canada the grizzly population is a little healthier than the population in the United States.
Black bear, though, goes further south? Is that
certainly, right? Yes. Yeah. There's black bear down in Utah.
And would Utah tolerate the expansion of the wolf population south?
I imagine it would be fairly controversial, uh-huh. as it is in the rest of the country. It might happen of its own accord. Time will tell, and certainly there are Utahns as well as people else there who would be interested in seeing that happen, and those on the other side of the fence as well. So.
Yeah. Are you acquainted with Edward Leopold?
Aldo Leopold, yes, mm-hmm. I am.
He wrote a book, A Sand County Almanac, and as I understand it, I came across this quote from him, "Conservation is a state of harmony between man and land." And he advocated the guideline that we should obey the law, vote right, join some organizations, and practice what conservation is profitable on your own land. The government will do the rest. Do you have his confidence in the government these days?
I may not have quite as much confidence in the government as Mr. Leopold did. The government is responsive to its citizens, and if the citizens speak up, then the government can act. Of course, citizens are not always completely in agreement, and those are the kind of things we have to hash out in a democracy. But I do agree with Aldo Leopold's concept of community, you know, including the natural world as part of our sense of community. And he was certainly a leading voice in the very early days of the wilderness movement in this country, and Sand County Almanac is a great book.
Mm-hmm. As I understand it, what is it, Earth First, and there are a few other more edgy organizations.
Their heyday is probably passed a little bit.
Is that right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. But others are popping up, I understand it. With respect to their kind of activism, challenging and even breaking the law in the name of the wilderness and mm-hmm. preserving the natural world, where is SUA, the Southern
SUA
Utah Wilderness Alliance?
Yes, SUA is not an organization that practices civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly there's a long standing of tradition of that within the church and within the country.
That's exactly
well.
Where it's going to go.
There are folks who do that, and it takes a full range of perspectives to gain success. But SUA's mission is really fulfilled by, you know, using the mechanisms that are granted to mm-hmm. us by the Constitution and through
working
the legal structure
the system.
Of the country. That's mm-hmm. that's correct. So, you know, have citizen lobbying and certainly the regulatory agencies and court procedures. We attempt to engage all levels and all branches of the government.
Utah, as I understand it, is one of, if not the lowest among states in the number of acres set aside?
Yes, certainly among Western
Which
states.
Which surprises me given the beauty of the land.
Given the beauty of the land and the extent of the land that is still eligible for those kind mm-hmm. of wilderness protections, it is kind of surprising.
There's a Western States Alliance, is that right? And Utah pulled out of it? Did I understand? I'm not sure.
That's not ringing a bell.
A couple of years ago, so. I thought there was a coal and oil interest, particularly in the north, and maybe this was a legislative initiative that didn't go through, but are you acquainted with the Western States Alliance?
It's a name that's not ringing a bell, but certainly there are oil and gas and coal resources in the state of Utah, some of which underlie—
I'm sorry, the Western Climate Initiative. That's what it is.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, there's a variety of organizations promoting mm-hmm. extraction of resources. It's worth noting that in the 9.5 million acres of land that is in the wilderness proposal, divided into 65 distinct units, there are some of those resources under that land. But for oil, we're talking about a week or less supply mm-hmm. for the country, and for natural gas, it's less than a month. Though they're there and there are some folks who could make some money out of that, there's probably more money to be made in the long term by protecting the land. A blip on the screen as far as the energy situation for the country is mm-hmm. concerned as a whole.
I understand that most of the population of Utah, 2 million some odd, live north.
Yeah, it's actually the most urban state in the country.
Right.
Because of where folks are concentrated in the Salt Lake Valley.
In 2008, the American Lung Association gave Utah a grade of F for particulate pollution and a grade of C for ozone pollution. Failed to beat national ambient air quality, primarily because of the quality of air up there in that regional area.
Well, Salt Lake Valley, which is a beautiful area, does have some difficulty in the winter with inversions where the pollution gets trapped in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a problem. In the Uinta Basin, which is up near the area of Dinosaur National Monument, where there has been some pretty extensive oil and gas activity in recent winters, the air quality in what is a very, very rural area has been nearly as bad as the air in L.A. and in Houston. And the Environmental Protection Agency is initiating some studies of that and has been encouraging the Bureau of Land Management to allow less oil and gas activity in that area in the meantime. While that's studied, and that seems to be.
So there has been a response to that in 2008?
Yes, and a lot of that is a result of legal initiatives that SUA and other organizations have initiated to encourage the implementation of the Clean Air Act as it pertains to these areas in the state of Utah.
We have about 9 minutes left, and we are talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh, who is the Midwest Regional Organizer Coordinator for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And we're talking about, the protection and conservation of Red Rock. What's the full title of the area, the Red Rock?
And we call it the Red Rock Wilderness.
Wilderness area.
And the legislation is America's Red Rock Wilderness Act,
right,
that would protect those lands.
And let's spend our time talking on that. But for those of you who are listening, you have just a few more minutes to call in if you'd like to ask a question of Mr. Doffenbaugh about this topic. The number is 333-9455. You can also call 1-800-222-9455. So where are you legislatively in this act?
The legislation provides the vision for the whole protected – the area that we would like to see protected. And the successes that we've had have come piece by piece as we've built towards accomplishing that whole thing. There's been two pieces of legislation that have designated nearly 500,000 acres of the 9.5 million acres of land that have passed through Congress. President Clinton designated the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which was well over 1 million acres of land in that part of the state, not quite as good as a congressional wilderness designation, but still pretty good.
What was the designation?
A national monument.
And the other one is?
It's a wilderness designation.
That's the better one.
And that's – Congress does that. And wilderness protection is really the highest form of land conservation anywhere in the world. And a national monument is a little bit less than that.
With wilderness protection, you actually get some enforcement teeth, right?
Well, it just has more protective measures for the land. There would be no motorized access to the land. Mm-hmm. The natural processes really take priority. And with a national monument, the protection probably isn't of quite of that quality. Each national monument is a little different. It depends on how the president writes the designation when they declare a national monument.
Mm-hmm.
Wilderness, there's a federal statute, the Wilderness Act, that defines what the purposes of wilderness are. And so that's a little more uniform in its protective status.
So where is it legislatively? Where in the track?
The legislation will be reintroduced into Congress. It's been around for about 20 years at this point. It tends to take a while to pass any legislation, wilderness legislation. It tends to take a little longer. And legislatively also, when you introduce something, you don't often always immediately get exactly what you introduce. And so we have worked, as I said, to get partial protections. And we've got some form of protection for nearly half of the 9.5 million acres of land in the citizen proposal that is embodied in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. But we would like to get, eventually all of that land with full permanent protective status. And we've come a long way. We have a long way to go. We have stopped the losses. That land is still eligible. And if we had not been doing this, that would not be the case.
When you say losses, what do you mean?
Well, acres that are become so disturbed that they're no longer of wilderness character. And, 50 years ago, there was twice as much as that would have been eligible for wilderness.
You mentioned a startling statistic in one of your articles in 1776. Almost all of the land was wilderness, and today it's down to
– certainly.
Or 1999, I think you mentioned, is 17%?
I think that's a figure applied worldwide.
Is that a global figure?
Okay. A global figure article in Science Magazine of some folks who did a study of that.
And the last 50 years has seen the most rapid decline.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. But Utah has held its own?
In the last 25 years on the lands – the Bureau of Land Management lands that are the subject of the citizens' proposal for wilderness, we've held our own.
Uh-huh. And when do you anticipate passage? I assume you are anxious to get this done within the next 2 years of the Obama administration, not knowing what the future will be.
I would suspect that in terms of passage of the legislation that will not occur in the current Congress. I think the environment is such in Congress that it's going to be difficult to pass any
budget
measures. The new leadership in the House Natural Resources Committee is largely opposed to wilderness. But even there are exceptions. Congressman Bishop from Utah, who is one of the most adamant anti-wilderness voices, actually passed the pieces of our legislation, two of our units for the Cedar Mountains region, as legislation that he introduced and President Bush signed into law. So there's always hope.
We have a caller from Bloomington, Illinois. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for your work. It's so important.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And do you have any predictions? I think just what you just said may partly answer, but any really long-term projections for the protection of our wilderness areas?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I come from the perspective that Martin Luther King had about justice, that we have our struggles, but the long arch of history, I think, will bend in our direction. But it doesn't happen without struggle, and it doesn't happen without a lot of hard work on people's parts. I'm hopeful that that we will ultimately be able to protect these lands, and certainly we've done well in stemming the losses at this point. And that's without much legal protection. That's just with the sheer will and effort of citizens in Utah and across the country.
Thank you for your call. We just have a couple of minutes left. I'm just wondering if you wouldn't, before we wind up, describe some of your peak experiences in southern Utah in the Red Rocks area. What is there that you can use with words to get people to understand why this is so important?
One of my first hiking experiences there was in a canyon outside of Moab, Utah, with my wife and our first son, Luke, who was a year old. We were hiking up this canyon towards an arch, beautiful canyon, 200, 300-foot red rock walls on each side, and came to a spot where there was a stream that carved a little amphitheater under there. And we went into there to rest. And I had Luke in a carrier on my back, and I took that carrier off my back, and I set it down in the sand there next to that stream, and took Luke out and stood him up, and he took some of his first steps right there in that spot. And that's one of those experiences that tells me why I do this work and put these very long hours sometimes in towards this work. But I also found out later that canyon was still there and still in a wild state because of the work of many people in Utah who prevented the construction of a road up that very, very narrow canyon. And it taught me that if we together don't save those places, we don't have those kind of memories and those kind of experiences.
Mr. Doffenbaugh, Clayton Doffenbaugh, thank you very much for being with us. It's a very interesting topic.
Pleasure to be here.
We've been talking with Clayton Doffenbaugh, Midwest Regional Organizer for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Next week, we'll be talking with the editors and translator, Professor Joel Green and Lib Caldwell, a new translation of the Common English Bible, new in 2011. That's next week, March 20th. With Chuck Cowger on resources for families dealing with family members struggling with frontal temporal degeneration. Thank you for listening. You're on Keeping the Faith. See you next week.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Recently, the House of Representatives passed H.R. 1, the continuing resolution, which eliminates federal funding for public broadcasting. Now the Senate will draft its version. It makes a difference when your senators hear from you that funding for public broadcasting is important. Contact information is at will.illinois.edu. Stay informed at 170millionamericans.org. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Each Week. Science and Religion, Rethinking Animal Intelligence, Maybe How Memory Works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.